Les colloques du Collège de France.
Okay, welcome to this afternoon session. The next speaker is Professor Anka Geus, who is Associate Professor at Central European University. She's a political philosopher that's interested in liberal egalitarianism and its implications on the family, broadly speaking, who worked before joining CU in various universities in Europe and has published a co-authored book that is called Debating Surrogacy with Oxford University Press, but is currently working on a monograph on child-centered child rearing, also under contract with Oxford University Press. And she is going to talk about socialist childhood, and she is eminently qualified to speak about socialist childhood because she has spent, like me, her childhood under socialism in Romania. So, very much looking forward to this.
I'm not going to talk about that kind of socialist childhood. Thank you very much, Lea, for organizing this and for inviting me. I'm really happy to be here, and thank you, everybody, for coming back after lunch. I'm also very grateful to Jan and to Nicolas for talking before me, because this is a conference about the potential debate, the comparison between socialism and liberal egalitarianism, and I'm not going to say anything about what each of these is, or at least not much, so I'm very happy that the people who spoke before me have done such a great job doing it. Rather, I want to contribute by drawing these comparisons between socialism and liberal egalitarianism, specifically while thinking about justice towards children, which means the question I'm trying to address is, from these two things that we don't have, socialism on the one hand and liberal egalitarianism on the other hand, which one would be better? And I want to say that as far as our childhoods are concerned, it's probably socialism. Okay, so in a nutshell, this is going to be the argument. The starting point is to explain why children are owed some distinct goods, namely some goods that are not owed to adults, and more specifically, enough guidance in the choices they make, equal childhoods, and opportunities to explore the world in a manner that is not too controlled by adults. That is, they are owed enough guidance as per the first good, but that guidance should not be delivered in a two hands-on manner. So the goods are distinct precisely in the sense that they are owed to us during childhood, but probably not during adulthood, for reasons that will become clear in a moment. Both egalitarian liberals and socialists, I think, can agree that these goods are owed to children in virtue of the stage of development at which children are and in virtue of their incompletely developed autonomy. So I am going to argue that liberalism cannot provide all these goods reliably to children, even an idealized and egalitarian version of liberalism that we don't have around. Of course, in existing liberal societies, children are clearly not having enough guidance, or at least not all children are having enough guidance. There are no equal childhoods, and children have less and less time to explore the world in a way that's not structured by adults. But there are principled reasons to think that they would not enjoy these goods either in societies that raise to the liberal egalitarian standards of justice. At the same time, I will consider the prospects of a socialist society of doing justice to children, and I think the prospects are better, although not perfect. So the dialectic of the paper is to first show that the liberal egalitarian commitments to justice towards children generate reasons to move towards a socialist society, and then very briefly at the end to ask on what might the decision turn, what kind of considerations. Okay, so let me start by saying a few things about children and adults. The fact that these three goods, by the way, I'm also very happy that Nicolas explained why good things always come in three, because I'm going to abide by this philosophical rule. And the fact that these three distinct goods are out of children is explained by the differences between children and adults. So on the one hand, during childhood, we're obviously slowly developing our reason, our self-control, as well as the stability of our practical identity, that is, how stable our goals, commitments, and priorities become over time. And for these reasons, until all these abilities are sufficiently developed, children don't have full authority over their lives. Therefore, children also don't have full liability for their actions either. They need more guidance because they don't have full authority over their lives. It's okay, it's even required for some people to tell children what to do in certain circumstances. And because they don't have full liability, they are also owed equality rather than mere opportunities to do things with their lives. At the same time, the pace of learning and creativity are superior during childhood, or so are many arguments emerging from different fields of empirical fields of studies. And for this reason, exploration has a very high value during childhood, since it enables optimal learning and the exercise of creativity. Their value is both instrumental and non-instrumental, so exploration has developmental benefits for the future adult in terms of their well-being and autonomy, but it also has final value in the sense that it's constitutive to well-being, and this is a point to which I will return. The first claim, I think, is quite common, so I will not elaborate on it here, because nobody denies that it's right to paternalize children to some extent in some contexts. The latter point may appear unusual, but neuroscience and child development studies support it. So here is a quote from a scientist who made a profession out of writing very, very popular books which explain science to the wider public. Her name is Alison Gopnik. And within a broader comparison, she draws between children and adults, writing that, I quote, "We used to think that babies and young children were irrational, egocentric, and amoral. Their thinking and experience were concrete, immediate, and limited. In fact, psychologists and neuroscientists have discovered that babies not only learn more, but imagine more, care more, and experience more than we would ever have thought possible. In some ways, young children are actually smarter, more imaginative, more caring, and even more conscious than adults are." So this is what Gopnik writes. And she explains the children's putative, outstanding cognitive abilities by appeal to the specific feature of their brains. So here is an evolutionary story. Children's prefrontal cortices are not yet fully developed, and hence they lack strong prefrontal control, which in turn, this control is necessary for the inhibition of information that is not vital to performing specific tasks, which is particularly useful if one is trying to accomplish something. Adults have this type of control. They are very good. We are very good, or at least comparatively good relative to children, at getting things done. At the same time, by helping to narrow down focus, prefrontal control is impeding general learning and free use of imagination. And that's the explanation of why after a certain age, perhaps just after puberty, we become a lot less curious and interested in a broad range of things and start to narrow down our focus. So in Gopnik's words, to be imaginative, you want to consider as many possibilities as you can, even wild and unprecedented ones. And in learning, you want to remain open to anything that may turn out to be the truth. This lack of prefrontal control explains why children learn so fast and have more of an open mind. And this explains their curiosity and greater propensity to engage in exploration in general. And I said this is part of an evolutionary story because she and her colleagues believe that this comes with evolutionary advantages for the human species. Namely, we spend our childhood exploring in a rather wild and unstructured way. And this is the hotbed of creative ideas on which later on, as adults, we draw and hopefully use them to improve the world. Okay, so the next question is how these features that set children apart from adults have any kind of bearing on justice. Okay, so here we see that three things are often not just the territory of philosophers, but also of political activism more generally. I want to say that during childhood, we have moral standing, and therefore, like adults, children are owed freedom and equality. And at least on some views, on a socialist view properly understood, I think they're also owed fraternité, understood as concern for their well-being, solidarity, if you want, with them. So they are also owed a form of fraternity which has to do with in making sure that their lives go well rather than merely that their lives are equal. But because the particularities of childhood that I just explained, there are some differences between what these requirements mean in the case of children and what they mean in the case of adults. So let me take them in reverse order. It will become clear by the end of the talk why I'm taking them in reverse order and discussing first fraternité and then égalité, and I leave liberté for the end. As far as solidarity or fraternité versus children is concerned, Their limited authority over their own lives is entitling children to guidance, as I said. And this is in contrast to the case of adults who are fully autonomous or who are assumed to be fully autonomous and who, according to what a core view of the liberalist doctrine says, have legitimate complaints against paternalism. So we may not seek to benefit adults in general, or at least not against their will. We need to get their permission in order to try to benefit them. But beneficial guidance is actually due to children, not merely permissible, but required. And it includes protecting children from very appealing, maybe even addictive, yet noxious activities. So for instance, somebody ought to set proper limits on each child's screen time, and somebody ought to protect children from their own susceptibility to give in to consumerist culture and the cult of quick fame. In existing liberal societies, many children actually grow up without guidance towards worthy ways of spending their time and worthy goals to aim for. Moving on to the requirement of equality, children's limited liability, the fact that they don't bear substantive responsibility for their own choices, entitles them to equal outcomes. And this again is in contrast to adults and what justice requires for adults. Again, according to a very central liberal credo, adults are entitled to only to opportunities, but not to particular outcomes. Because they are free to lead their own lives, adults are also liable for many of the resulting inequalities. They may spend their money in the casino and then live on little until the next salary if they wish so. For one thing, imposing outcomes on adults who would offend against their authority to decide about themselves. But ensuring equal outcomes for adults would also mean that sometimes redistribution from prudent to imprudent is required, from the rest of us to the unlucky casino gambler. And this seems to be very unfair towards the prudent. So children, in contrast, don't bear responsibility for their decisions. And for this reason, they are not owed mere opportunities, but actually equal childhoods. And yet in existing liberal societies, it's a commonplace to say that children are not enjoying equal outcomes and equal childhoods, but rather very unequal access to housing, food, education, medical care, valuable pastimes, and even access to adults who have enough time for them. Finally, freedom. Children's interest in exploration is necessary for their well-being and development, as per the explanation I just gave, is powerful enough to explain their right to freedom from too much time structured by adults. In existing liberal societies, a race to the bottom means that children get enrolled at even younger ages in social competitions for advantage. Their free time is increasingly crowded out by goal-oriented activities imposed by adults who are anxious about their children's future success, and not without reason. So the question I want to turn to now is whether egalitarian liberal societies, as opposed to actual non-egalitarian capitalist liberal societies, would do any better by children. And then to ask the question of what about socialists? So let's start again with fraternity. I said that limited authority over their lives means that children are owed guidance in deciding how to live. But as an effect of two features of liberalism, it's unlikely that even the egalitarian version can deliver for children everything that children are owed with respect to solidarity towards them. So the first feature, which featured in one of the previous conversations we had this morning, is liberal neutrality, which says that states should refrain from supporting any particular controversial ethical ideals, some particular ways of leading one's life as opposed to others. Neutrality restricts the reach of institutions in providing ethical guidance to anybody. And in the case of schools, liberal neutrality allows and even requires that children are provided with knowledge and dispositions they need in order to become autonomous individuals. So they should learn how to read and how to do maths, and they should learn facts about the world. But schools, according to liberals, may not nudge children towards good lives. They may not tell them, for instance, that becoming a YouTube influencer or spending money on status-conferring goods is a silly thing to do. And some philosophers actually believe that the neutrality requirement applies to parents as well, and they might be right, but I don't have time now to look into this controversial and intriguing proposal, which would make even worse the prospects of liberals to deliver justice to children on this count. So this leaves, if institutions may not outstep their commitments to neutrality, this only leaves parents and maybe other adults from the life of children to provide guidance to them. Um, But, and this is the second feature of liberalism, liberalism sees child-rearing as a private individual project. So the only people who actually have duties towards guiding children are their own guardians, typically their parents. However, some parents are unable or insufficiently motivated to provide such guidance to their children. So not all children in a perfectly liberal society can be guaranteed enough guidance. It's just a matter of luck whether any particular individual is able and willing to provide good guidance to the children in their care. And of course, the state can have some remediary duties in cases where adults fail children very badly, but the failure is very difficult to discover and is very difficult to compensate for. Now, is socialism doing any better on this count? I think that insofar as socialism includes a principle of solidarity or community, and you may correctly think that it doesn't, that's a very debated matter, but insofar as it includes such a principle, it can justify duties on institutions like schools and likely also on all members of the community to guide children towards one of the various plausible models of a good life. That's because a principle of community, as Jerry Cowen formulated it, is the requirement that people care about and, where necessary and possible, care for one another. By caring for and caring about, in this case, one should really understand, are invested in the well-being of others. And indeed, one objection to this principle is that it is paternalistic towards adults and that a state that tries to enshrine it in its institution would follow full of the neutrality constraint. But if this degree of paternalism toward adults, the default intention to benefit them, is in fact acceptable and even required as socialism has it, it would surely also be permissible towards children. Moreover, socialism is likely to have the theoretical resources to transform child rearing from a particular project into a cooperative venture. A principle of community could hardly let parents shoulder on their own the burdens of child rearing, on the one hand, and on the other, it would not leave the fate of children to a large extent to the luck of having better or worse families or guardians. So let us move now on to equality. Because of their limited liability, children are owed equally good childhoods, that's what I said. But this, I think, is difficult for even an egalitarian form of liberalism to deliver. As Genstock made it clear, a proper egalitarian form of liberalism would restrict very much the scope of inequalities relative to what they are here and now. But it would still be the case that liberal freedoms taken together entail a number of features that make it impossible to deliver equal childhoods. First, liberals must admit must put primary responsibility for children on their parents, and that's because it seems unfair to impose on others responsibility to the people for the people that one has brought into existence without consulting anybody else. So liberalism has this view about parenting as a private project on which some people engage, and we are morally free to engage in this project or not, and once we engage in it, it's our duty to accomplish it well. Second, liberal commitments allow some outcome of inequalities because people may work at different jobs for longer or shorter hours and thus accumulate more or less wealth. Even if all jobs were paid the same, there would presumably mean no compulsion that people work the same number of hours. Third, liberalism also must allow for inequalities in choosing one's pastimes and spending choices, which means that different adults will lead very different and unequally beneficial for children lifestyles. And finally, liberalism also obviously allows access to family life for everybody who would make an at least adequate parent. Together with the previous features, this makes great variation in the quality of parenting both possible and very likely. Moreover, liberalism guarantees the protection of family life from constant scrutiny, and the right to privacy makes it very difficult to even identify and to interfere with forms of parenting that are in principle at odds with liberalism, such as child abuse and neglect. So together, this generates significantly unequal childhoods as the kind of default that we can expect in a liberal society. The most that liberalism can do is to strive to compensate, to create policies that mitigate this baseline of inequalities between children's lives, for instance, by offering additional schooling or other educational activities to children from less privileged families. But I take it as the vast literature on child rearing and the inequality, the transmission of inequality in the family shows, I take it that the prospects of getting close to equality are dim, and we can mostly hope that liberal institutions are going to alleviate the worst kinds of inequalities between children. Again, do we have any reason to think that socialism would do better on this count? I think yes, and for two different reasons. First, the inequalities of wealth between parents would likely be more limited in socialism. Again, a principle of community like the one that I have mentioned earlier, proposed by Jerry Cowan, curbs some of the inequalities that are allowed even by the most egalitarian versions of liberal principles, such as the principle of fair equality of opportunity, because precisely because this principle allows for significant equalities between people, it also corrodes community. And if socialists are committed to communities, they are also committed to disallowing sometimes of inequalities of outcome for the sake of community. And some of the inequalities of outcome that would be disallowed are those between different parents. So the result is more equal baselines of childhoods. Second, the freedoms of family life and privacy would hopefully endure under socialism. But as I mentioned already, child rearing would be more easily made into a common project in which the state and members of the community even are primary duty bearers for children's well-being. Because parents will always be important, and because they will always be unequally talented, unequally invested into their children's lives, and more or less well fitted with the children they are raising, some inequalities will unavoidably persist in, I guess, any kind of social organization. Full equality between children seems inachievable, but shifting the main responsibility from individual parents to the community would make it easier to have equality of condition between children as the baseline from the kind of default from which some inequalities may be unacceptable, rather than have inequality as the expected baseline and for the state to scramble to find solutions to the worst kind of inequalities. So I'm arriving at the third requirement, which has to do with children's specific kind of freedom, which I think is owed to them. So I said that the children are entitled to explore and therefore to freedom from adults guiding them in ways that are too hands-on. And as I explained, findings from various sciences indicate that this has benefits both for children while they are children, and they have benefits that regard autonomy formation and expected well-being during adulthood. If children are free to explore and learn without having too many goalposts set for them, they can make optimal use of their learning abilities and creativity, and this makes for better childhoods on several understanding of well-being. Again, we're coming back to a discussion we had earlier between Jan and Chiara about the importance of creation in one's life. Well, if the science I rely on is correct, it looks like most of the opportunities to enjoy this art during childhood, partly because that's when we feel like being creative. On a subjective account of well-being, according to which it consists in positive mental states, freedom is good because it's fun. And on an objective account of what makes our lives go well for us, learning and creativity, which are enabled by freedom, are also constitutive of well-being. Similarly, childhoods that are not too regimented have various developmental benefits. The problem is that exploration requires plenty of unstructured time, that is, freedom from having one's goals established by others. And for children, this has opportunity costs because it detracts from training them for future competitive success, or it can detract. To make this point more vivid, I'm inviting you now to imagine a series of highly stylized stories about the social organization of work and the extent to which it makes space for play. So this is just a placeholder, it's a very stylized example that I'm going to work with. So this is the first winter, and it has been snowing for the entire weekend, and the public transportation stopped working, schools have closed, and children are given a day off school. Instead, they are playing in the snow for hours. Adults struggle to go to work and carry on with business as usual. And this is an image that indeed I remember from my own childhood, which, as Lea said, happens to be in socialist Romania of the 80s. But I assume that many others, maybe some of you who grew up in liberal societies, have similar memories. It's a world of carefree childhood and serious adulthood, where children and adults lead partially separate lives and often enjoy a very different set of good things. But over time, the story goes, this arrangement becomes unsustainable because competition increases and permeates all spheres of life. Parents become aware that their children have optimal competitive advantage if they attend the most competitive universities, for which they have to attend the most competitive schools, for which they need to attend the most competitive kindergartens, and so on and so forth. They start to think that each unit of time should be harnessed to improve the child's competitive advantage, and they are not entirely wrong. And that's because important goods in this society, such as healthcare, higher education, decent jobs, are only competitively available, not available to all members of the community. Those who lose out on the competition must pay a high price. So this is a collective action problem. The more parents take away children's unstructured time in order to train them for adulthood, the more each individual parent is under rational pressure to do the same. And schools respond to the same incentives, because no school wants its pupils to fall behind. And so a few years later, let's say a generation later, we have people living in a very different world. So again, it has been snowing the entire weekend, and the public transportation stopped working. Adults struggle to get to work and carry on with business as usual. Schools closed, and children who don't get a day off on such occasions receive additional homework by email. They concentrate on independent study and try to make sure they don't fall behind with it. In fact, by now, they hardly have any opportunities to play in the snow, since even when they are not in school, they are doing homework and have their time organized around play dates, sports, arts, foreign languages, and other educational activities. Many of them don't even have the material conditions to enjoy a snow fight because the communal spaces have been open to traffic. 20 years later, most of those who grew up in this generation, in this second world, will be, in some respects, perhaps slightly better off as adults than the children in the previous one. Some will have a slightly more rigorous work ethic, and as a result, the generation will, on aggregate, be slightly more prosperous in material terms. But the people in this generation will also tend to have poorer emotional development and relationships, and will be less creative, so they will have lower overall life well-being. Most importantly, they will have missed out on a good childhood. This is a world that one can easily recognize in today's reality, one of serious childhood and serious adulthood, in which children and adults lead more similar lives than in the world of the first winter, because children are not having access to some goods which plausibly are distinctively valuable for them, like exploration, like the typical freedom of children. Liberal egalitarians, of course, must deplore this situation. They can recognize it as inimical to satisfying children's claims of justice, and this is reason for them to try to contain it as much as possible. For instance, they can limit the volume of homework that schools are assigning on a snow day or on any other day. They can reduce the pressure to go through formal exams and qualitative evaluation at ever younger ages. They can advise against excessive hands-on parenting, because all these things are bad for children. However, as long as child rearing is primarily a parent's responsibility, a private project, and as long as very important goods are only competitively available during adulthood, the reach of state action is very limited. The competition in the world of adults trickles down in the sense that individual parents almost always have sufficient reason to privately organize their children's time with an eye to promote their competitive advantage. So can socialism do better? It seems so, again, for several reasons. On one count, a socialist society in which child rearing is a common task and not a private project would presumably socialize children's lives to a greater extent than any liberal society would. And it would be up to the institutional design to build in large pockets of unstructured and maybe unsupervised time for children. Equally importantly, by making the conditions of decent life non-competitively available to all those who fully cooperate according to their ability, socialism would remove the primary motivation of parents to train their children for adult success as early as possible. In fact, a socialist world might slide into yet another kind of winter tale. So it has been snowing the entire weekend and the public transportation stopped working, schools closed, and children are happily playing in the snow for hours. The government grants a national holiday to everybody, but all adults and children have to take turns in cleaning the road and providing emergency services according to their ability. Organization gets occasionally messy, but this is a scheme of sharing drudgery and all other socially necessary work that has to be done. Adults join in the play, and in the evening everybody eats reheated leftovers from the previous days. Nobody worries too much about damages to the economy, which do not affect basic necessities, and everybody is ready to share equally in the losses. This is quite crucial to the success of this scenario. In the middle of snow fun, adults often forget they are grown-ups and play with each other just like the kids. So this is a world of mostly carefree childhood and relatively carefree adulthood, one in which the intrinsic goods of childhood are also amply available to adults, although adults cannot benefit from them quite as much as children. So this story is possible in a socialist society not only because the reach of competition has been curbed, but also because the society is abiding by a principle of community in which gains, here gains in fun, are equally shared, as well as losses, here losses in economic productivity, and burdens, here burdens in community work. So everything is shared, and this enables even adults to enjoy some of the type of exploration and structured play that is the privilege of children in other kinds of societies. Okay, so let me now take stock. I said that children's incomplete autonomy and their developmental stage means that freedom, equality, and concern for their well-being, which here I named fraternité, generate different requirements than in the case of adults. That much is something that liberalism can accept, and I also said that socialism does well enough on all these counts, on which even egalitarian versions of liberalism fail children. If so, I think that we can call socialist childhoods those childhoods with opportunities to explore, with equal well-being, and with sufficient guidance from adults. But it looks like this is providing a conundrum to the liberals. So, on the one hand, if you agree with me, we are owed something closer to socialist childhoods than to the kinds of childhoods that would be possible in an even egalitarian version of liberalism. But on the other hand, socialism is ruled out by the liberal commitments to personal responsibility, state neutrality, and freedoms of occupational choice and associations. It's hard to see how in a liberal society, state may try to turn child rearing into a fairly collective kind of enterprise, for instance. It looks like the liberals who are facing this conundrum have two options. They may be willing to moderate their liberal commitments in order to make them compatible with justice towards children. Perhaps they may go as far as conceding that certain features of a socialist society are required because we are starting lives as children, all of us, and as children we are entitled to these kinds of social features by justice. The features I have in mind are primarily ensuring that all cooperative members of society have non-competitive access to goods such as decent jobs, healthcare, higher education, and this is in order to contain competition in the world of adults, and switching to a more communal way of raising children in order to ensure that all children, rather than only the lucky children, enjoy well-being and guidance. Alternatively, liberals may decide to take childhoods seriously, maybe too seriously, may decline to take childhood too seriously. They could return to the traditional view that children lack full moral status and therefore that they cannot have claims of justice. Or less extremely, they might think that liberal commitments are required to ensure goals that should be abandoned, for instance, that severely limiting adults' freedoms to raise their children as they wish and imposing on them responsibility for other people's children would be wrongful. In this case, sacrificing children's interest would be a regrettable thing for the liberal egalitarian, but it might be all things considered justified. And I have no idea how to solve this conundrum. I don't even know whether I myself am more of a socialist or more of a liberal egalitarian who has worries about all these matters that I explained. But I just want to leave you with this type of worry and say a few things about reasons that might incline liberals towards one or another of these two solutions to the conundrum. So let me say a few things about the importance played by how one sees childhood, its worth, and its value in judging this matter. So here are three ways of understanding children, to answer the question, what's a child? They are not mutually exclusive, but different liberals and more generally different philosophical outlooks, I think, give different ways to them. And this matters for conclusions about the importance according to the question of justice during childhood. One may think that a child is primarily an unfinished adult, in the sense that one cannot access significant well-being during childhood. On this view, only during adulthood can we have our best shot at a good life, because it's during adulthood that most important things can get done. It's only during adulthood that we can create our most impressive life plans and carry out with their implementation, for instance. That's the only time when we have the reason and the self-control and the stability of practical identity required for this. Alternatively, or complementarily, one may think that a child is an unfinished adult in the sense that since it is during childhood that we can acquire, that we acquire full reason, only during adulthood can we achieve the greatest kind of dignity which human beings are capable of. Children are imperfect adults in the sense that they have not yet risen to the level of reason that adults are capable of. Finally, one may think that a child is a human being with a superpower, because only during childhood can most of us fully access the goods of learning and creativity, which are central to a good life, except perhaps for the lucky adults who become professionals in fields that require creativity and learning all the time. So the more weight one gives to considerations of the third kind, I think the stronger the case seems for designing societies which give priority to children's well-being, even when there are conflicts between children's and adults' interests. I think this is the right way to take, but I have not argued for it here. But even if this were the case, socialism for children's sake puts some limits on individual adult pursuits, and yet it clearly comes with some perks for adults as well. Thank you.
Collège de France, le savoir en illimité. Retrouvez tous nos contenus audio et vidéo sur notre site collège-de-france.fr, les plateformes de podcast et nos chaînes YouTube.